Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, this is Cultural Baggage.
It's not only inhumane, it is really fundamentally un-American.
My name is Dean Becker. I don't condone or encourage the use of any drugs, legal or illegal. I report the unvarnished truth about the pharmaceutical, banking, prison, and judicial nightmare that feeds on eternal drug war. Welcome to this edition of Cultural Baggage. In just a moment, we'll have our guest for the evening, Peter Crist, a retired police captain and one of the founding members of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. And their website is www.leap.cc. My friends, the drug war is a complete and utter fiasco. And all you have to do to make that determination is to ask any member of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Before we begin our interview with retired police captain Peter Crist, I invite you to visit our website, www.drugtruth.net. And there in the lower left corner, you'll find a link to a recent BBC Channel 4 presentation of prison abuse in the United States and Abu Ghraib.
Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad and photographs that shocked the world. Iraqi prisoners humiliated, tortured by American guards. George Bush said he was appalled. This was not the American way. More American guards screaming abuse at naked prisoners. But this is not Baghdad. This is Brazoria in Texas. This happened when George Bush was the governor of Texas.
Again, to hear this full documentary, please visit our website, drugtruth.net. And now for our interview with Peter Crist. We're proud to have with us today one of the directors of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, Peter Crist. How are you, sir?
How you doing, Dean?
I'm well, sir. If you will, tell the folks a bit about your experience in law enforcement.
Okay. I'm a retired police captain. I work for the town of Tonawanda Police Department, which is a major suburb of the city of Buffalo. We had a residency of about 85,000 and about 100 to 110 officer department. I retired in 1989, as I said, as a captain. And since then, I have been involved in drug policy reform.
Yes, sir. You've been doing this about as long as anyone. Now, tell us how you got started in this law enforcement against prohibition.
Well, the idea for law enforcement against prohibition was something that rolled around in my head right soon after I retired. The concept for the organization comes from the old Vietnam Veterans Against the War, which was an anti-war group during the Vietnam period. And this was a group of people that were service people who had served in the military and now were speaking out against our policy in Vietnam. And whether people agreed with their position on the war or not, at least that was a group that nobody could accuse of being cowardly or unpatriotic or whatever, because they had gone and fought when they were asked to, and now they came back to tell us we were involved in the wrong war at the wrong time. And from that, I thought that a group from law enforcement speaking out about drug policy and the flaws in our drug policy in this country would have a similar effect. When you have an organization like LEAP, which is our membership is all people that have been in law enforcement at some time in their life, some even currently, you cannot accuse us of being a bunch of long-haired hippies who think that drugs are cool. That isn't what we're talking about. We're talking about the policy of prohibition, which has been a dismal failure in this country, not just between 1920 and 1933 when we tried to use that to deal with a very serious drug problem called alcohol, but even today when we try to use that policy to deal with our drug problem in America.
You know, Peter, it occurs to me that over the decades of the drug war, we put tens of millions of people in prison for little baggies. Would we not be better served had not the police been out looking for murderers and rapists during that time frame?
Well, absolutely, and there's been a lot of wasted time and a lot of wasted effort. It has accomplished nothing. Well, it all depends, as a friend of mine says, on what you're trying to accomplish. In the 1950s, heroin was primarily a major big city problem. Now we have heroin in every little community all throughout the country. So I don't know if that was their goal, but that's certainly what they accomplished with this policy. What the flaw lies in is not whether drugs are good and bad. In my opinion, drugs are terrible. You shouldn't use them. Be as drug-free as you can be and all that other stuff. The fact is that they are so dangerous, these drugs, that they must be regulated and controlled. And the problem with our current policy is it takes away all regulation and control by instituting a blanket prohibition. And what that does is it gives us no ability to control any aspect of the drug marketplace. For instance, who sets the purity for heroin in America today? The Food and Drug Administration? No, the mob. Who sets the age limits that they're going to sell to? The local state legislatures? No, the mob. Who decides the distribution points for these drugs? The zoning boards? No, again, the mob. And who gets and decides where they're going to spend all the profits from these drugs? Again, the mob. That is a terrible system. It creates crime and violence in our society that we need not have. There is certainly a problem with violence and crime that's associated with the use of drugs. But most of the crime that we associate with drugs in our society today is not associated with people being high on drugs and hurting other people. The vast amount of crime that's associated with drugs today has to do with the marketplace disputes, people fighting over who's going to sell what where, who's going to be in charge of the gang in what city at what time. And that violence is not created by drugs. That violence is created by the prohibition that we have in effect.
Peter, you know, the fact is we spend, some say, $40 billion, some say as much as $100, $120 billion each year here in the United States fighting this drug war. And yet what's often overlooked is the fact that we give approximately $500 billion to these cartels and terrorists and you know, violent gangs for being the purveyors of the black market.
Exactly, exactly. We are financing the people that are trying to kill us. And that is bizarre when you think about it. A couple years ago, during the Super Bowl, the Office of National Drug Control Policy ran an ad where they basically said, drug use in America supports terrorism. Well, I heard that, and I thought to myself, gee, that's wrong. I have not read any reports that Marlboro or Maxwell House or Budweiser are supporting terrorist organizations, and these are certainly drugs that we use in America. So what's wrong with that statement? I looked at it for a little bit, and then I realized the flaw in the statement. I can change one word in that statement and make it perfectly true. If instead of that statement saying drug use in America supports terrorism, you take the word use out of that and you put in the word policy, and now that statement reads America's drug policy supports terrorism, now it's more accurate, and it's also more scary. Because our policy supports the people that are trying to kill us? Well, that's the reality of the situation. Our policy of prohibition creates an underground marketplace. That underground marketplace is fed on by the underground, by the gangsters, by the terrorists. If I was a terrorist and I needed money to build a bomb, I'd certainly, why not sell drugs to do it? I'm willing to blow myself up. You think I care if I'm arrested or not? So we create this marketplace. How can we do something about that? The way we can do something about that is by shutting down that marketplace and creating a legalized marketplace where we can regulate and control these things.
I hear stories that the Colombians provide most of the heroin that comes to the United States, but that in the Northeast, the price is falling, the purity is increasing, and overdose deaths are starting to increase as well because people just don't know what they're buying.
Well, that's absolutely true. Most of the overdoses don't come because people are stupid and want to kill themselves. Most of the overdoses come because of impurities in the drugs that they're getting. You know when you buy a bottle of beer how much alcohol is in it. It's right on the outside of the label. Same with a bottle of whiskey. You have no idea what you're getting from one day to the next when you buy drugs on the street. And obviously, having this be there is not deterring people from using drugs because they continue to use them. What we have to do is, my mother had a lot of little rules in life that she used to give me. I was one of those fortunate people that had two really great parents. And my mother used to say that if you have a problem in life, there's a three-step way to deal with it. Step one, make the problem go away. And how do you best do that? By solving it. Good advice. Step two, if you can't do step one, then you have to seriously consider running away from the problem. And I know that sounds like cowardice to people, but think of yourself being in a building and somebody yells fire. If you're not a fireman and you're smart, you know you can't handle that problem, so you get out of the building. Step three, if you can't do one or two, if you can't solve it, if you can't make it go away, and if you can't run away from it, then you have to learn to live with it so it does the least amount of harm in your life as possible. I've done over 1,000 Rotary clubs and Kiwanis clubs and Lions clubs, and every presentation I give, I ask this question. Put up your hand if you think we can make drugs go away. No more heroin, no more cocaine, no more marijuana, it's all gone. And nobody ever puts up their hands. So we accept the fact that no matter what we do, they're always going to be here. A lot of us in this society tried to run away from drugs. We left the big cities and ran out to the suburbs because we thought we could hide from them. Well, what happened? All of a sudden, the suburbs were full of drugs, weren't they? So if we can't make them go away, and if we can't run away from them, then we have to live with them so they do the least amount of harm. Right now in America, most of the harm that we associate with drugs, as I said earlier, is associated with marketplace disputes. People fighting over who's going to control the market, people settling disputes about who owes who what money. That is something we can do something about. That is some way, a way that we can reduce the harm. The only way we can do that is to move to a legalized, regulated marketplace.
Well, sure, I've often heard it said, when was the last time you heard of a Coors distributor shooting a Budweiser distributor?
Exactly. Well, that situation that just happened up in Canada where those four Mounties were killed. On a marijuana grow operation raid that they were on. That wouldn't have happened if that was the health department going to check out the Molson Brewery. They wouldn't have been shot at the door. They would have come in and done their inspection because it's a regulated marketplace. We can do something about this problem. We can also, and that's another bad part of the prohibition, we can't even educate properly. We can't talk about safe use of these illegal drugs and teach people that there is a way to use these things safely. I'm not telling to induce people to use, but it's just like sex education. We tried for a long time to use abstinence only as our sex education method, and it was a dismal failure. For the first time over the last couple of years, we've seen a reduction in unwanted pregnancies in this country, and that is on the heels of us teaching two things now. One is we teach, don't do it, abstain, and then we teach, but if you're going to do it, here's how to do it more safely. That's what we have to be able to do with drugs, and we can't even do it. And that doesn't even get into, I'm 58 years old, I'm right at the lead edge of the baby boom. I saw my generation raising children. I personally, Paul and I have been together for 33 years, and we chose not to have children, but a lot of my friends had children. And I sat there while I watched friends of mine lie to their children about their past experiences with drugs. They didn't lie to them about their past experiences with nicotine. They didn't lie to them about their past experiences with alcohol. But about all the other drugs, they just denied, denied, denied. In fact, all the way up to the top office in this country, we just learned recently that President Bush lied to the country about his drug use because he didn't want to set a bad example for the children. Well, what's a worse example? I use drugs, and I smartened up and I stopped using them and I straightened my life out. Is that a bad example, or is lying a bad example? I think lying is a worse example.
I've drawn the correlation that President Bush, through his experience and change in lifestyle, is a walking billboard for success after drug use.
Exactly. And there should be hurrahs going up for that. Not hiding it. You know, it's absurd what we're doing, but we're going to continue to do it for a while because we haven't allowed ourselves to be educated to the fact that there actually is another way to deal with this problem.
Okay, we're going to take our midpoint break here. We'll learn about a good politician, and I hope you can name this drug, you women especially. Of nepotism, bribery, and greed, Tom DeLay has no such need. Make no mention of the media's attention, for Tom DeLay is a good man. judges be damned and the living dead judged. No way that delay can ever be budged. Christian, Repub, and American. Tom's words are sweet. He's from Sugarland. It's time to play Name That Drug by Its Side Effects. Corneal curvature, migraines, dizziness, mental depression, chorea, loss of scalp hair, nausea, vomiting, cramps, bloating, cholestatic jaundice, gallbladder disease, uterine fibromyalgia, vaginal candidiasis, colomasa, erythema, hemorrhagic eruption, and here's thudism. Time's up. The answer, Premarin for hormone therapy, another FDA-approved product. Okay, you're listening to Cultural Baggage on the Drug Truth Network and Pacifica Radio. Our guest for today is a 20-year member of law enforcement, a retired police captain, Mr. Peter Crist, one of the founding members of law enforcement against prohibition.
Well, Peter, over the time that you've been a spokesman, I think first for Reconsider and then for LEAP, what's been the response from the audience when you give your speeches?
The most common response, and I call these the 24-karat responses, and they even start out sometimes by saying, look it, I don't agree with you on this. But then they say this, I don't agree with you on this, but I never looked at it this way before. And I get that response from every presentation I give. I get people that are there, I agreed with you before you even came here. I mean, there's always them. They've been quiet because they didn't think they could talk about it. But a lot of the vast majority of people just never looked at it this way before. They thought drug legalization meant that drugs are really cool, man, and we ought to legalize them and everybody can have some. And all of a sudden they hear a retired police captain standing in front of them who isn't even hinting at that, who isn't even suggesting that, who in fact is clearly saying that he doesn't feel that way, but who is saying drugs have to be legalized so that we can regulate and control them, and what we're doing now is counterproductive to what we're trying to accomplish. And that's something that it amazes me, but they've never heard before. And it's interesting, once you've heard something you've never heard before, you can never look at that thing the same way you did before. You have to look at, next time the term drug war comes by you, you have to look at it differently because now you have this other image in your head that there's another way to deal with this problem. And that's what we're trying to accomplish at LEAP, is to get that word out to people.
I have sidewalk discussions with people about the drug war. And many times you can point out the failings and the better chances we have by changing our stance. And when you reach that point, for some people, they just can't hear it. They actually walk away, no, I don't want to hear it, and they will leave the discussion.
Well, yeah. I mean, look at how long the Catholic Church didn't want to hear that the earth wasn't the center of the universe. You know, even the Pope supported that for years, up until, you know, about 10 years ago, they finally acknowledged the fact. We get caught up in our myths, and we get frightened to leave them, to let go of them. One of the things that I think frightens us is we think, if I let go of that, do I have to let go of everything else that I've been believing in? And that's not the case. The thing that we have to understand is there have been many times in the history of our species on this planet when the majority has been wrong. Slavery was never a good idea. Eve should have had the right to vote. All right, it shouldn't have happened in 1920 that women finally got the right to vote. It should have always been that way. Segregation was always stupid. But we did it for years and years and years and years until we woke up to the fact that what we were doing was counterproductive to what we were trying to accomplish. You know, you mentioned earlier that most of the heroin in America comes out of Colombia.
Yes.
That's a success of the drug war, you know. I don't know if you realize that or not.
Explain, please.
Well, back in the mid-90s, during the Clinton administration, we contacted this little family group that lived in a country about halfway around the world, and we offered them $300 to $400 million for them to suppress a crop that was growing in their country. The country was Afghanistan, and the family group was called the Taliban. You've probably heard of them. Well, we gave them, over the period of a few years, about $400 million to suppress the opium crop. And in fact, they did a pretty good job of doing that. They really did. In fact, it got to the point that in Western Europe, there was actually, for about an 18-month period, a shortage of opium on the streets because of this suppression that was going on in Afghanistan. It got the cartels so nervous about being able to get opium out of Afghanistan that they tried something different. And that is, they started growing opium in South America where it had never really been grown before. And you know what? For some reason, it took. In fact, now we have opium coming from South America, as you stated earlier, being the primary source of opium for America. And not only that, but now that we've gone in and knocked the Taliban out, as we've all read in the paper over the past few months, there's a bumper crop in opium coming out of Afghanistan, now that the Taliban's gone. And now opium in Western Europe and throughout America, as you also stated earlier, is cheaper, more plentiful, and purer on the streets of America than it's ever been before. All that is brought to you by the people that support the policy that we are following in this country right now. Now, I don't consider those things successes, because, of course, I'm not in the drug business.
Right, right. Now, Peter, we talked about the fact that the majority feel that it's improper to speak of the need for change, and yet, even in Texas, we found that 75% of the people to a Howard Scripps poll want medical marijuana at least available, and yet the same people also indicate they feel the majority don't agree with them.
Well, yeah, it's we are barraged by the other side. I mean, I've been in the drug policy reform movements, like I said, since 1989. We don't have nearly the funding that the Office of National Drug Control Policy has. And they go out and they keep sending the same message over and over and over again. It's interesting. I have a standing offer to debate anybody anywhere on this issue. Our whole organization has a standing offer. All of our people will be glad to debate prohibition with anybody who wants to debate it. We cannot get anybody to debate this issue. We have had DEA agents who said, yes, they will do it, and then when they tell their boss what they're going to do, they tell them, no, you're not. Now, if I wanted to debate medical marijuana or marijuana legalization, I'm sure I would get people coming out to debate me. But when it comes down to the fundamental principle of prohibition, they all know that they can't uphold the concept. It's a failed policy. It's always been, there has not been on this planet a successful prohibition pulled off by any society that ever tried it, ever, in all our history. In fact, when I do presentations, I like to mention the first failed prohibition we know of. You know where that was, right?
The Adam and Eve?
That's the one, you know. Absolutely. Do not. And in fact, that was the first case of zero tolerance, too. No exceptions. And how many people had to be watched to make that prohibition work? Two. We know their names, Adam and Eve. And who was the cop for that prohibition? God. And now, if any prohibition was ever going to work, that would have been the one. But it doesn't. The simple fact is that our species chooses to do what they want to do. And we take advice from people about whether it's good for us or not, but then we go out and we make our own choices. And it's, you know, we have to understand, one thing we have to understand very clearly is that there's two classes of laws in our society. In the legal profession, they refer to them as the mala in se laws and the mala prohibitum laws. And what they do is they define that there are one group of laws, for instance, murder, robbery, rape, those kind of laws, that has a very clearly defined victim who's screaming for help from the criminal justice system to make their wrong right, and we pass laws to enforce those things. Those are all those laws. We prohibit murder, robbery, rape. Those are prohibitions. Now we have this other group of laws, the mala prohibitum laws, and these laws are things that people do because they want to do them. I want to place a bet. You're willing to accept my bet. But one of the listeners listening to this program doesn't think you and I should be betting. They think that's bad or immoral, so they make a law against this behavior. But we're perfectly happy doing it. The difference between the mala per se laws, the real crime laws, and the mala prohibitum laws, which are the laws that we make up because we don't like stuff that people enjoy doing, is very profound. People will argue that the fact that we have a law against murder reduces the number of murders in America. We can argue that point. I happen to disagree with it. I never arrested anybody in 20 years of police work who, when they committed the crime, ever thought they were going to be arrested for it. So the fact that it was against the law really didn't make any difference to them. But even accepting that it reduces murder, I will make, I'll bet everything I own that we do not have one more murder per year in this country because we have a law against murder. You follow what I'm saying? Nobody's out there killing people because they make it against the law. Well, I'm going to show them. That isn't the reason that people kill people or rob from people or rape people. On the other hand, when you get to the mala prohibitum laws, you actually create crime in your society. We have more crime in this society today because of these prohibitions that we have put on certain activities between consenting adults than we would have if we simply regulated them. Let me tell you a little learning lesson, a little learning experience that we should have picked up on. There used to be a multi-million dollar illegal underground operation in America. The mob ran it. They employed 10, 11, 12-year-old kids to help them make this money, and they made money hand over fist. In some cities, they made money so fast they had to weigh it instead of counting it. And we tried in law enforcement to stamp it out, and we couldn't touch it. And then one morning we woke up, and you know what? It was gone. They just shut the whole operation down all by themselves. Amazing. Now, that was the same day that a thing called the lottery started. Because when we changed the name of the numbers racket to the lottery, we took all that money away from the gangsters. And now we don't have 10, 11, 12-year-old kids running numbers for the mob anymore. We don't have people getting beat up rather than getting paid if they win. We have control over where the profits are spent and where the tickets are sold from. Now, are there still people on a Friday that are going to take their whole paycheck and blow it on lottery tickets and not feed their family? Yeah, that's going to happen. But that's a much smaller problem than the problem we had before with the numbers racket. What we decided to do was legalize it, regulate it, and control it. We're doing the same thing throughout the country with gambling of other sorts, casino gambling and stuff like that. We decided that a regulated and controlled marketplace for this activity was much better than letting the gangsters run it. And that's the same thing with drugs.
Well, Peter Crist, I do appreciate you joining us here on Cultural Baggage and Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, LEAP.cc. I think you guys are the point on the spear, the battering ram that's going to tear down this wall of prohibition.
Well, all we can do is keep banging the drum and hope people listen. And it's thanks to people like you who gives us access to the public that we will get people to listen, I'm sure.
To which I can only say that, yes, you must listen, but you must also act to end the madness of drug war. A couple of program notes. I want to thank the good folks up at CHLY up in Nanaimo, British Columbia, for inviting me on their Elephant Talk show this past Saturday morning. I would also ask that any radio stations out there that are carrying the Drug Truth Network programs, please give me a shout and let me know so we can add you to our list of affiliates. Contact Dean at drugtruth.net. Be sure to join us next week when our guest will be Cliff Thornton of efficacy-online.org. We'll be talking about cost analysis of the drug war, local level reforms, African American outreach, and the comments of the Camden, New Jersey police chief who said that without the crack trade, the city would collapse financially. And as always, because of drug prohibition, I remind you, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful. For the Drug Truth Network and our affiliates in the U.S. and Canada, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Jap dancing on the edge of cannabis.